Welcome to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. I'm John Strickland. In this podcast series, we're gazing into our crystal ball, peering through the mist, and trying to get a clearer picture of what the industry may have in store for it in the next 20 years. It's always been an industry subject to shocks and upheaval, some natural, some sadly man-made, and that's certainly the case now, and it's not likely to be any different in the decades to come. One massive challenge that is getting ever larger is better sustainability, and that could actually be at odds with the anticipated industry growth in the years ahead. Across the series, we've been exploring where the industry might be in 10 to 20 years from now, and I've been speaking with an incredible range of leaders, drawing on their experience and knowledge and applying their thinking to our podcast to better define the key drivers and influences which will shape our future skies. So it seems fitting that in this final episode of this current series, my guest is someone who spends a significant amount of his time looking at precisely these factors. He's had an extensive career in the key commercial functions of network planning and revenue management in Delta Airlines, and has held a number of roles with his current company, Boeing, culminating in his current position as Vice President, Commercial Marketing. So let's meet my guest today, Darren Holst. Welcome to Our Future Skies, Darren.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Great. Good to have you here. Now, Darren, I touched on your career there, but do you want to elaborate a little bit more, man and boy, how you got started and where you've got to today? I know there's some similar bits to my own career, as you know.
Sure. I guess if we want to go all the way back, I graduated university maybe a semester early. And so I had a little bit of extra time before potentially going to graduate school, and decided to see if I could get a part-time job at the airport. And so I started on the ramp and at the ticket counter, and fell in love with actually the mechanics of commercial aviation. And at a small airport in Michigan where I grew up, I actually started spending the time between flights, studying where airplanes flew and how airlines priced, you know, itineraries, and ultimately went from there to network planning at Delta, which was just, you know, kind of a, almost like a dream come true job in terms of just, you know, putting together the puzzle that is airline network schedules and how to connect people. And so I did that for almost 10 years down in Atlanta, and made connections in the industry, and ultimately really found my way to Boeing to help on a global level Boeing's customers in terms of network strategies, and ultimately demonstrating how airplanes and the choice of airplanes can maybe make a difference in airlines fleets and ultimately their business success. So kind of a continuum, but really it gets back to the fascination with commercial aviation and how people and flights and networks connect.
I think that kind of emotional buy-in is very important to a lot of us in the industry. You know, we do get that early addiction. It just stays with us, and we try to build on it into, you know, the very serious kind of work that you're doing today. Now, I know you've already given a couple of clues about what your current team does. I know one of the things you produce is something called a CMO. It's well known in the industry, and people like me wait with bated breath every year for this document to be released. CMO stands for Commercial Market Outlook, where you do what we're doing now on the podcast, looking to the future. Tell us a bit more about that. What does that mean, and what does it comprise of?
Sure. The Commercial Market Outlook, which for many who probably followed Boeing and the industry for a long time, probably remember it. It used to be called the Current Market Outlook. Mm-hmm. The Commercial Market Outlook has actually been a document and an analysis that Boeing has produced publicly now for more than 60 years. I believe it's since 1961, but it's an outlook for commercial air travel, air cargo demand, and ultimately what that means for the new delivery demand for commercial aircraft over a 20-year period. And like I said, it's something we've done for more than 60 years. I want to say, without too much pride, that it's kind of a standard in the industry for helping to really, you know, separate ourselves from, you know, the current dynamics of the industry and really figure out bigger picture. What's the long-term perspective for demand? What drives increases in demand? What drives changes in demand? And ultimately, how does that influence and impact our need to make new aircraft, make different aircraft, and what types of production rates that really requires us as an industry to contemplate, not just today or tomorrow, but over the medium and longer term. So it's something that I think is really important, especially in times of crisis. It's something that Boeing and our team has done even during, the depths of the pandemic. For example, in 2020, we produced a commercial market outlook. After 9/11, we produced a commercial market outlook, because I think sometimes in those instances, it's almost more important to make sure that we provide that perspective, because sometimes you can only see so far in whatever industry or ever part of the industry you're in, and it helps to have a bigger picture perspective, because as we all know, the resilience of commercial aviation has been and proven time and time again, but every now and then you need a reminder of those fundamentals.
No, it's interesting that you say that, Darren, because it made me flash back to those grim years of pandemic actually chatting with you. And I
Right.
remember, you then coming out that particular year and asking you, how on earth are you doing it this year? How on earth are you going to work out the future? Because
Right.
everything seems to be up in the air. Well, maybe up in the air is exactly what it was not. Everything was on the ground. And
Right.
it seemed like the industry was massively thrown off course. But I remember you talking with confidence, not in any way from arrogance, but, well-argued confidence. And then, of course, here we are now, fortunately, out of that pandemic, and things are indeed back on track. And the way you described the document as a reference point, and the longevity of 60 years or so it's been produced, I was going to make the point that it has had an incredibly high level of reliability. And I'm certainly far from a pure statistician, but I certainly see it tends to be pretty close. Maybe the composition varies, but the overall picture is pretty close.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. No forecast for 20 years is ever going to be, precise in terms of where we are, but I think the
Exactly.
consistency and the fact that we look at the industry every single year to try to incorporate new dynamics, new considerations, new elements really helps us to be consistent, and also I would say really, manage and understand the insights that are coming at us as an industry from an annual or a case-by-case basis. And so if we look back, for example, in 2004, 20 years ago, our commercial market outlook, or I guess CMO at the time, projected roughly the same amount of airplanes that the industry actually delivered. We under forecast single aisle aircraft. We over forecast regional jets, because I think as many of us might recall, the early 2000s had a lot of regional jets flying around, and it was kind of the glory days of that type of aircraft. But overall, we were pretty much on target, and I think that perspective helps I think validate the need and the importance of continuing to do these outlooks every single year to provide those long-term perspectives.
Absolutely. And as we set off now to discuss some of the broader issues, I would say the context of our conversation today, Darren, is the most recent forecast that was completed a few months ago shows a projected pretty well doubling of the current airline fleet up to around about 44,000 aircraft over the next 20 years. So let's now take a deeper dive on some of those factors that are going to be future influences on that outturn. If I can start off, Darren, something that you and I love to talk about, airline business models. Do you think we're going to see a change in the mix of business models over the years? I mean, it's a complicated question because we've seen it. If we look back 20 years, we couldn't have predicted exactly what's happened. But now it seems to me the lead model in terms of its influence, if not fully in competition, is low-cost carriers. But then we still have hub carriers with hub and spoke flights. How do you see that kind of balance evolving?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think over time, and I think the last 20 years are a great example of this. The LCCs, the low cost carriers, and the stimulation that they've provided, not only in advanced economies, but especially in emerging markets, has really been the driver of growth for our industry. But what's fascinating is if you look a decade earlier, network airlines, hub and spoke carriers, developing those networks were really the drivers of growth. And I think today, looking forward, it's really a mix. Some airlines that are LCCs have carved out an incredible space for themselves and continue to drive growth despite, I would say, pretty mature size in terms of fleets, whether they're in Europe or the United States or other advanced economies. But low-cost carriers in emerging markets, since the pandemic, in some cases, have a little bit been starved of capacity to resume growth. And so I think they're still that pent up demand in the market for some of those key regions of the world to resume those trajectories that we saw before the pandemic. So I think LCCs really are a key to growth. But I think one thing that we've found since the pandemic is that, network carriers, because of the diversity of passengers and the diversity of products they offer, from, very short haul, I would say almost like regional connectivity, all the way to, long haul global travel, it's really become a value for passengers and for the global transportation system. And we've seen airlines kind of figure out that there is value there, and there's also value in providing maybe more differentiated products for passengers that really value that one-stop shop in terms of the capabilities that a global network airline or a global airline network can provide.
And I certainly think the network airlines have learned lessons from the low-cost carriers. I mean,
Yes.
we both share some career history in network airlines, and there were things I remember when I was a network planner. I never considered elements that later became essential, not least management of costs, which low-cost carriers have as their absolute bedrock of their thinking.
Yes.
So we have the low-cost airlines still pretty strong and likely to be so. And as you say, some development network carriers by no means going away and still having something to grow and develop as well. We have some other more peripheral models. I mean, you talked about regional air travel, which you see is under pressure. Certainly, as we speak today, we know in the US market, that's something that's faced decline in part driven by pilot availability, but it's whatever happens, it's a smaller segment. Any comment you want to make on that?
I briefly could, I guess, and going back to your question on the business models, I think what's interesting as the market matures even more is that it's harder and harder, or at least more difficult to differentiate, in some cases, what a pure low-cost carrier is, what a pure network airline is, because each business model and each airline business kind of mimics or adopts elements to their network and to their business plan that makes the most sense based on, the customers that they serve. And so I think it's harder and harder to draw a hard line when you characterize various airlines. And I think that's a good thing because it means that they're optimizing the product, they're optimizing their network for the right customer set that they're going after. And I think that's what's most interesting. And when we look at the regional space, to your question, I think what we've seen is airlines have realized we need to offer as much network connectivity as possible, but we also need to do so at the lowest cost per seat. And if you're pressured from a cost perspective because of limited resources, whether it's pilots over the last few years or the economics of an aircraft that has fewer seats, I think we've seen some shift into those single aisle jets that used to be served by regional jets. And ultimately, that enables airlines to offer a more efficient, maybe lower fare to customers, but also maintain connectivity. It might not be the same amount of frequency, but ultimately, it helps airlines optimize both the resource side and the capacity side. And so that's a trend I think probably continues as we move into the second half of this decade.
That was certainly interesting to watch that one. And then again, back on maybe more long haul type markets, we have other models such as long haul low cost. That one to me, as we speak today, doesn't seem to be sticking as easily. We've had airlines that have failed. We have airlines that are still currently trying. Doubtless there'll be new ones. It's my impression is that's not going to get as big in long haul as it has done in short haul, and you can't map the, if you say the tick box elements of short haul low cost into long haul, it needs some very specific support from perhaps particular traffic flows to make that work.
It seems to, I mean, going even back as far as, 10 years ago, I think the one thing that we all saw when we watched some of these business models come out of into the market is fuel prices and fuel costs become such a larger portion of the profit loss equation the farther you fly. And also, if you think about it, cargo is an important part of long haul. And both of those things really start to neutralize the benefit or the advantages of LCCs the further you fly, because gas costs the same regardless of the business model in most cases. I mean, it's pretty much a commodity. You're not getting an advantage there. utilization of the aircraft is largely the same the further you fly. And so now, where are the elements that you're actually going to generate a cost advantage? And then, as you probably can appreciate as well, the further you fly, the more that passengers are willing to pay a premium for a premium experience. And sometimes that is the difference between winning and losing in a market if you can offer a premium product. And so I think that's where we probably agree that there'll probably be some successes here and there with low cost long haul, but it's not going to double or triple the size of the market like it did in the short haul LCC space.
Well, and another one that's maybe even more niche than that, and coming back to your point about premium travel, is ultra long haul travel. We've seen that taking off a little bit. It started with. We had another series guest, Alan Joyce from Qantas. I was talking to him about the starting from Perth, Western Australia to London, using the capability of the 787. He looked at himself into the future and talked about this Project Sunrise when he threw down the gauntlet to yourselves in Boeing and Airbus. That one, the roll of the dice was Airbus, and we wait to see that one for Sydney to London. But that seems very much about premium travel, because you're cutting out the stops. You've got to make it a very comfortable ride if you're going to be on an aircraft 17 plus hours. It's working well from what he has seen so far, but I again wonder if that's going to be something that's going to go very wide, and again perhaps remain rather niche.
I agree. I actually agree. And while we'd always love to sell, as many of our aircraft to as many customers as possible, I don't think that ultra long haul is necessarily a massive growth market, or at least in terms of the number of aircraft that segment of the market demands. What I think is valuable about an aircraft like the 787 is that it can just as easily operate a domestic Japanese flight as it can the Perth London flight that you talked about. And so not having to have a separate airplane or a separate, infrastructure for operation is a huge value because it enables airlines to be, much more versatile and flexible with their fleets and their networks and not have to compromise, for the longer term. If you're putting extra tanks or extra structure in the aircraft just to fly those ultra long haul missions, if that doesn't pan out, you're stuck carrying that extra weight and cost for, the life cycle of the aircraft. And that's something that over time has proven itself to be, a challenge.
Well, that again point you mentioned there about versatility of aircraft. I'm going to come back and have a good discussion about aircraft in a few minutes. I just want to address a couple of things leading up to that point. You mentioned again about types of passengers and premiumization. What are your thoughts about the trends for passengers, both in terms of motors of travel, any differences in generational outlook and geographic in the years ahead?
Oh boy, that's a. I could probably talk for the rest of the podcast on this. I'll start with some of the unique, interesting things I think we've seen, and it ties into an earlier response I had. I think generationally, in markets like North America, in Europe, and even Northeast Asia, as passengers and as the demographics are getting slightly older and maybe also slightly more affluent, you're seeing passengers who are traveling for leisure being willing to buy up in terms of the experience that they're interested in having on the aircraft as part of their overall travel experience. And so over the last 10 years, but especially I would say over the last 5, the success, the value of a product like premium economy has really shown itself out. And it's because you have, for example, maybe retirees or upper middle class passengers who want a better experience are willing to pay for that extra space, and that's something that airlines have recognized and found ways to monetize in many ways as they develop their products and their networks. And in some cases, that could be the stepping stone to business class travelers, to premium leisure travelers. And I think that's something that will continue as we see more diversity in the types of passengers that are flying, just as much as we see, emerging markets and developing economies see the value of low cost and how densification in the cabins can actually enable them to serve markets and to stimulate traffic that wasn't possible a decade ago when the GDP per capita or the affordability just wasn't there. And so I think just like I said before on the the blurred lines between network and low-cost carriers. We're also seeing blurred lines between the types of passengers. You've got leisure travelers flying up front. You've got business travelers flying, in economy. And it's all, I think, a positive because airlines are able to serve all those passengers with diverse products.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as you said, I mean, again, I was very surprised coming out of COVID. I thought the days of premium cabins were gone. Everybody would be looking to put as many seats as they could because it was just going to be about price. Business travelers wouldn't travel at all. They'd just be doing online meetings and so on. But so far, it's certainly not the case. And as you said, the geography comes into that as well. I mean, we have a difference of direction in terms of, as you said, premium cabin and densification. Just one thing, not to go too much down the rabbit hole, because there's too many topics I want to ask you about. But densification and the economy cabin, where it tends to be putting as many seats in as possible, airlines are doing that. Do you see maybe any innovation where, even if there are more seats, there's maybe some more comfort comes in because airlines in the past have been able to maybe shift the curtain. At least for business cabin short haul, they've had pretty fixed seating on long haul. But I've seen a couple of images of, like double decker seats so you can slide your feet more under the seat in front, or people almost like bunk beds in economy to get some comfort. I think we had Air New Zealand was one. They had a kind of a sleeper row. Do you think maybe more of that would happen that will allow airlines to get the seats? But if you are ultra price driven, you can still get some extra comfort in economy.
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, innovation is the hallmark of aviation, and it's what's enabled us as an industry to offer essentially 2% annual, fuel savings improvement per year for decades. And I think that's a testament to airlines just finding ways to innovate over time. But I also am a realist in terms of saying I think it's going to be more of an evolution than a revolution in terms of what products are really offered in terms of being really. I mean, you go to some of these conferences or some of these exhibitions and you see pretty novel, products and inventive things. But those things need to be certified. Those things need to go through a lot of rigor to actually become real. I do think, though, that we will see continued evolution. Air New Zealand's a great example of an airline that's very innovative, but in a practical way. The Sky Couch and some of their other proprietary designs have really enhanced how premium economy and even economy cabins have been laid out. And the same, kind of trends I think will continue. So we will see that focus on how do we get revenue and value at one end, but also how do we continue as an industry to be able to offer the lowest costs where that is a critical element of providing that service. And I think that's what's fun about this industry is that we never sit still.
Absolutely. And talking of which, another element which doesn't stay static is geography, global geography, in terms of the mix of aviation. Do you have any views about which markets may or how market shifts may potentially shift in the decades ahead? I'm thinking about areas of perhaps potential growth. At the moment, we're seeing very interesting things in the Gulf, India, China, for example. What are your thoughts there, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about those two big economies in Asia, roughly the same population between India and China, not nearly the same level of traffic and commercial aviation activity. So the way I think about it is China is maturing. We're talking about a region or a country that's airlines. Really, their fleet is about 4,000 aircraft. And on the other side, India's fleet total is less than 700. And so it's, roughly one sixth the size of China. And so I think it'll be fascinating to watch the growth in India because in many ways, I think it will mimic what happened in China over the last 15 to 20 years. But it needs to grow at double digit rates for a long time before it approaches the size of China. And so what I think looking forward will be interesting is China's entering a phase in its maturity where we're going to see replacement waves of aircraft for the first time in high volumes, which in many ways is even more stable source of demand. I mean, when you need to replace an aircraft, it's a lot more stable than the speculation of growth. But it's also, I think, a reflection of the maturity and the size of networks and airlines in China. So fascinating to me to watch both of those economies, both of those industries continue to develop and grow. And obviously, by far, those are the two largest population centers in the world, and you can't ignore them in terms of the potential that they unlock. The value of the Middle East isn't necessarily in the population, but it's the geography. Increasingly, in a world that has to fly around certain airspaces with the Russian overflight restrictions, the Middle East continues to be a great spot. It already was great geographically, and now it's even better in terms of serving, so much of the global market, especially long haul. But in the case that we just talked about, huge population centers are also easily connectable. So I think it's not something that has risen and fallen. It's something that will continue to rise in importance, and that business model has proven itself to be pretty resilient despite some of the challenges that we've seen over the last decade.
And it's interesting that we've had Tim Clark has been another guest on the series, and when we think of the whole lifespan so far of Emirates, there was a tiny population in Dubai, and while they've grown to this enormous hub status, so too the population of Dubai has grown. So they've actually generated a point-to-point market which simply didn't exist in the past. And then you look at a neighbor like Saudi Arabia. We've also had guests from Flyadeal and Riyadh Air on the series, and that's something brand new. I mean, Saudi Arabia's been a big air market, but it seems to have so much upside because it's got a very substantial population.
I guess what I would go back to is even, thinking about the fundamentals that drive air travel, it's hard to extract the connectivity between global air travel and global economic development. When you're connected to the global economy via air, it has a synergistic benefit. And so, for example, I mean, you talk about Dubai and other, cities that have come from very small and continue to develop their own networks. But even in the US and Europe, if you choose to hub in Atlanta or in Denver or in Charlotte, those local markets benefit because corporations decide to put headquarters there. When you're connected to the global network, it's everything's accessible, and you have this follow-on effect where it's really a win-win situation for the economy as well as for the connectivity. And I think that will only continue as different parts of the world. And I look to Africa, for example, as another place where there's a ton of potential, and some of this connectivity can really create, really a snowball effect in terms of how it really builds, I think, the opportunity in some of these markets.
Well, I was going to ask you there exactly that, your thoughts on Africa, because in the forecast, it always remains pretty low. And yet you look at it, the sheer size of the continent, the number of young people, the difficulty of surface transport. And then again, we had a former CEO of Ethiopian, Tewolde Gabrimariam, on the podcast. And we look at what Ethiopian has developed with that substantial hub in Addis Ababa. And I remember him talking about people were in disbelief. I think when he was ordering his first 777s, they couldn't believe he was doing it. And now he's many aircraft orders later. He's not at the helm, but he created something which is very much sustainable. Yet Africa as a whole, it hasn't got there, and really it deserves to get there in the decades ahead.
It does. There's so many reasons why it does. One, you have the largest youth population in the world in terms of, that's the future of growth for many economies. You also have the size element. You think about transcontinental, US flights as kind of a good standard of air travel. You have essentially a continent that spans three transcontinental flights, depending on whether you're looking, north to south, east to west, or across the horn. And so there's so much geography that needs to be transitioned or transited if you're a passenger. And the biggest opportunity to me, I think, is liberalization. So many restrictions around flights, so many challenges to freely accessing markets. And if those restrictions can be dropped, we see what happened with, the EU's open skies. We see what has happened in ASEAN, for example, and I think that'll continue. There's, I would see 2 to 3 times that much opportunity in Africa. And yeah, it's coming from a low base, but it truly does have a tremendous amount of potential. And you might have to measure it in a decade as opposed to a year or two.
Absolutely. And just in terms of the mature markets, if you like, the US and Europe, do you imagine there could be relative decline over the decades ahead, or
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating question. I think what's interesting is if we look at how the world emerged back out of the pandemic, what's fascinating to me is the growth came out of the North American and European markets. Those are the airlines that realized the market was changing, that realized the opportunity to, maybe replace fleets, but also grow fleets and change the way they do business based on changing, patterns in the market. And so I always hesitate to bet against the, advanced networks and economies because there are just so many ways that airlines can reinvent themselves and drive growth because there's so much demand for air travel in these markets. I mean, before the pandemic, I think we all probably remember the market was growing above average, 2015, 16 to 2018, 2019. The market was actually growing 6 or 7% a year instead of 5%. And that growth was coming out of the US and Europe, which was a little bit of a paradox given the fact that both of those markets were among the largest in the world. So usually you don't see those dynamics, but it was because airlines' business models were evolving to serve the growth demands that were happening. And I think that will continue over time. In Europe, ultra short haul, absolutely shrinking. However, the value of connectivity in medium and long haul is still something that is, hard to compete with from an aviation standpoint. And it's something that airlines are adapting to. And so I really think those will continue to have growth. It's just we're talking 2, 3, 5% growth and not, 5, 10% growth like we'll see in emerging markets. So healthy, balanced, and probably focused more on replacement, but still not shrinking.
Interesting. And when you're preparing the commercial market outlook, Darren, do you in any way try to factor in changes in things like that, geopolitics? We're talking at a time of incredible geopolitical challenges. We see governmental composition seeming to change in many parts of the world to a more nationalistic outlook. Do you try to factor that in as whether that might have a dampening effect, or is it just really impossible to do?
I'll say yes and no, and I'll say that, I mean, in anticipation of maybe another question, which is, do you factor in global recessions? The answer to the question is we factor those things in. We know that, aviation, commercial aviation, and global economies, tend to have cycles. We don't predict when the recessions are going to happen or maybe when there are going to be geopolitical issues that emerge, but I think the fact that we've never been in a market or a world without those phenomenon is reflected in our outlook. So we moderate where it makes sense. We try to understand how those will affect flows and global demand. But we don't necessarily try to call out the year or the quarter when those things will occur, understanding that bigger picture, the market's resilient and adapts to these things over time.
Good stuff. Let's move on to the aircraft topic
Sure.
itself, Darren. You talked again, we mentioned versatility. We've seen changes in models, if anything, moving towards, in the long haul arena, smaller aircraft than we saw in the past. We've got more narrow body twins, which started life as purely short haul and going to ever longer distances and indeed truly long haul flights. And then the other end of the spectrum, I mean, certainly I shed a tear. You probably shed a tear when the 747, finally went out of service. In most airlines, there are some of the later versions around. I was here in the UK when BA let the last two go. And we have the A380 on Airbus's side, but even that is going to disappear and it's flying apart from Emirates in fairly limited numbers. How do you see this mix evolving in the decades ahead, especially as the larger aircraft go? And we maybe don't get very much new airport capacity, perhaps especially in mature markets.
Sure. I think that's a great question. It's one that probably has a lot of different, elements in terms of how to answer it. First of all, I'm with you in terms of the 747. I'll go out of my way if I can to fly on the 747 flights that continue to exist around the world. But, when you talk about economics, twin engine wide bodies have taken over, and also versatility is so important to airlines when they think about, commonality and how they deploy and redeploy aircraft across a fleet. And so that's where I think, the 787 has really proven itself over the last decade as being, the versatile backbone of long haul travel. Yeah, there'll be airplanes, that are larger and that are needed. However, a family of aircraft that cover between 250 and 350 seats really enable airlines to optimize without having to pay extra on the cost side for that flexibility. But longer term, there absolutely are constraints from an infrastructure standpoint. There absolutely are growth opportunities that exist, even in dense markets like the New Yorks and the Londons and the Dubais of the world. And that's why that we think that there is a market for aircraft larger than, say, the 787. And that's why the 777X family exists, and why I think a 400 seat jet with two engines becomes very, very compelling, because it really takes jumbo jet capacity with twin engine economics and makes that kind of what I would say the long haul market standard for trunk routes that airlines need to fly and will continue to need to fly over time. It's just when you have two families of aircraft, when you have an ultra versatile and you have an ultra high capacity or a high capability aircraft, and both of those are on efficient cost platforms, it just enables airlines to both expand and grow in their core markets.
It's interesting because I remember seeing the 777X flying. I think it's one of its first public displays at the Dubai Air Show. What would it be? Would it be 3 or 4 years ago now
It
from when we're
was, I
speaking
want to
today?
say, yeah, I want to say it was 2021.
Yeah, around about that time, I think. And it is a large aircraft. It can carry more people than its predecessor 777, but it's theoretically a little bit smaller than the 747 or the, obviously the 380 on paper can carry 800. Nobody carries more than, I think, 600 in reality. It's a case of ultimately probably what the airlines will do in terms of the configuration, how much will they use of its capacity, and it will that give them enough ability to grow from constrained airports by putting a larger plane in, but not needing more flights.
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, I think in some cases you're going to see airlines upgauge into that, but you'll also see airlines right size from the 47s and the A380s into that aircraft because the economics are just too compelling. When you have two engines, when you have the cargo carrying capability, it becomes a really compelling solution. And yeah, it might require maybe a little bit more frequency over time to match the capacity, but the economics are just overwhelming.
And at the other end of the spectrum, I touched on narrow body twins, which are getting into long range operation. The route served by your 737 MAX, route served by Airbus's 321 LR and XLR aircraft, which are coming on stream. I mean, that sounds to, I don't know, the undetailed observer, a great thing, a small plane doing more direct flights. But it doesn't always tally exactly that way, does it? Because it doesn't mean because you've got a smaller plane that the market is necessarily big enough to put it on a long haul route if you're not feeding it in the sense of a hub.
I agree. I think very similar story to what we talked about earlier about ultra long haul flying. There's absolutely a segment of markets where a longer haul single aisle aircraft will make connections that just weren't possible with previous generation single aisles or with, previous generation small wide bodies. We're not seeing the scale of the number of markets that means that this is going to change the game from a long haul perspective. Partially because, those single aisle jets still run out of range capability, which means they run out of flexibility. And on the second kind of hand, if you think about the overall equation for profitability, these single aisle jets aren't carrying any cargo, and that cargo element becomes a valuable piece of the equation for long haul jets, especially the wide bodies that, you could see 10 to 20 tons of cargo carried on any specific mission. And so we will see more connectivity. It absolutely, will add more connectivity. I just don't think it's going to dramatically change demand for wide bodies nor the shape of global networks, partially because of the connectivity you talked about, but also because some of the limitations that inherently exist on single aisle jets.
Darren, just some quick fire questions on
Sure.
aircraft as I need to move on to a couple of other topics in the time we have. Where do you see innovation coming from in the next 2 or 3 decades after your 777X or 777-9 as one of the
Yeah.
series gets on stream? We're not seeing new aircrafts currently on the book, books for either you or Airbus. Boeing has indicated it seems to warm up for a period of time. At the moment, it's in abeyance, so I know it's still being thought about. Where do you see that innovation coming from 10, 20 years ahead for the next new models?
Sure. I'll start probably a little bit of a cop out, but I'll start by saying the one thing that I think we'll continue to do no matter what is invest in the products that we're making. So the 737 family will see continued improvements. The 7 and the 10 entering the market are very important, but also whatever we can continue to do to improve efficiency, capability will be investments that we make. Same thing with the 787 and the 777X. On top of that, I think as we look into the longer term to really look into, say, the second decade of the CMO and even beyond, is there are more constraints in the global market over time. The market's getting larger. There are constraints at airports and in certain key markets. So, a new jet is probably going to have to reflect, some of these constraints in terms of the size of the aircraft, in terms of the size of some of these emerging markets. And so my estimate would be, over time, a new product probably comes in, maybe a little larger than today's single aisle aircraft to accommodate some of that growth. But it really is going to be a function of the technology that's available at the time, the demand, and the fact that these aircraft will need to be flying for decades and decades beyond, our careers in the industry.
And do you think we might see new players edging in a more significant way? I'm thinking particularly of China, which has already got an industry in producing regional jets, and of course a very large home market that they can tap into in terms of airlines wanting aircraft. Maybe other countries like India as well for future production of aircraft.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the one thing that I think is good and healthy is competition is always good for the industry, and it just forces every player to stay at the top of the game in terms of the engineering, in terms of the support, in terms of the quality, all the elements that make our industry, the safest and most efficient way to transport people. But it's also a challenging industry to get in. I mean, ourselves and Airbus have been in the industry. They've been 50, we've been over 100 years in the industry, and we still, it's a challenge from a supply chain standpoint, from a development and production standpoint, because it is such a complex industry. And so I think some of that competition probably takes a long time to emerge just because of the complexity in designing, building, and supporting a large-scale fleet.
And other end of the spectrum, do you think we may see some air travel fall away with, say, rail substitution in those markets where it makes sense to have rail and high-speed trains?
I do, and I think we should be open about it. I mean, in ultra short haul or domestic type markets, and I think intra-Europe is a great example. We probably won't see growth, and in some cases, we'll see diversion, but in a healthy transportation environment, you see that connectivity actually enhanced. You see partnerships and, networks grow that connect rail systems to air systems. Because once you get over a 5-ish hour rail journey, air travel really is more efficient, more effective. And so how do we, as an industry or as a bigger picture economy, help, facilitate those connections, but also recognize the efficiency in both of those systems to make the most out of it. And I think that really is the key. And so different speeds of growth for sure. But the value of air travel really comes through when you get to places that can't be efficiently accessed via rail or ship or other modes of transportation.
As you say, I mean, that's the advantage of time for air travel. And with that in mind, what about supersonic? And we had the glory days, even in my career, of Concorde, and that's long gone. What, more than 20 years gone? There are a number of people, as we speak, with various projects. Are you a believer that could come back in a meaningful way or not?
That's a great question. I mean, as a airline geek or airplane geek, I love the idea of supersonic air transport. I mean, the Concorde was cool, However, the Concorde was 15 airplanes between two airlines connecting two routes for the vast majority of its life. You know, I think it was New York, Paris, and New York, London. How you make a commercially viable supersonic network that has, you know, a large scale of demand and production is it's harder for me to see. And you know, the physics of flight at supersonic speeds, I mean, it does take a lot more fuel, whether it's conventional or sustainable aviation fuel. It takes a lot more to fuel those aircraft. And so I don't know how those, you know, competing elements kind of ultimately end up. But I do think it is a challenging market in terms of the size ultimately that you need to have in order to make a truly premium market successful.
And another sensitivity of supersonic, which leads me into the next topic, is that of sustainability and impact from super high altitude flight and the amount of fuel burn. On that broader topic of sustainability, Darren, and we've talked about the reliability, the incredible accuracy of the commercial market outlook over the years.
Sure.
Do you think we might be getting into a bit of a kind of a standoff now between the need for the industry to deliver on its credentials for sustainability against its not only a desire to grow, the economic need to grow from economies around the world? Could that put us at odds? Because we're not moving as quickly as we need to at the time we speak in terms of advances. We've had some optimistic developments for short-haul travel, be it turboprop or jet, that may come to fruition in the next decade, turboprops in particular on short regional flights. But the big elephant in the room is that long-haul travel. Whatever aircraft we have in our lifetimes and somewhat beyond are still going to need to be powered by similar engines to today, even if they're powered by sustainable aviation fuel rather than kerosene.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm obviously not an airplane development expert or an engineer, but I'm smart enough to know that you get above 100 seats and you get above 2,000 miles, and it's gonna be a long time before you can power a jet like the 737 or the A320 size with anything but either kerosene or sustainable aviation fuel. And that's why sustainable aviation fuel really is the only way to get to the industry's goals in the time frame that we're looking at. And it's why scaling and investment in the production of large scale sustainable aviation fuel is really critical. It's great to see the innovation in that smaller spaces, and I think it's in many cases and in many ways an incubator for technology that we'll see in future generations. But the key in the near term is SAF.
And in terms of, I mean, we have challenges, and then they're too specific to get into it for us today. You know, we have a challenge of investment to produce enough SAF, and of course, it can be produced from many different sources. Are you hearing anything about something completely different in the long term? I think, again, I've heard Tim Clark say nuclear is the ultimate solution. Are you hearing about any work being done on that for long haul travel at this point?
I mean, practically speaking, I feel like nuclear would be a great technology to exploit for, you know, land-based power needs. So it's not something that I have any knowledge of from an aviation standpoint. But to your other question, I mean, there's other ways to create sustainable aviation fuel, whether it's power to liquid, whether it's, you know, other ways to extract that carbon and turn it into a usable fuel that I think will evolve and emerge over time because there's just so much innovation in that space. And it's something that I think the industry will benefit from. But I think, you know, again, the subsidies, the recognition that investment needs to be incentivized is something that is really important because to your earlier point, I think there also needs to be the recognition that aviation serves a huge purpose in terms of the global economy. And it's something that we need to, you know, balance that need for sustainability with the absolute imperative to continue to help grow the global economy, which is really a global need.
I'm just wondering there, linked to that, with governments showing different approaches that we talked about, markets that are growing strongly and certainly see that value fully of aviation as an economic tool, be it the Gulf region, India and China. I wonder if we might end up seeing some demand suppression, conscious demand suppression, either by governments. There are some unusual things, for example, in Europe going on as we speak in terms of airport capacity restrictions. If sustainable aviation fuel is to be produced in larger volumes, it may be priced at a high level. That could be suffocating some demand anyway.
Yeah, I think it's possible, and I think when you mandate or restrict, that absolutely is an artificial way to really limit demand, and it's probably something that has damaged longer term to the greater economic activity in the region, and that's it might just shift where the balance of commercial aviation and economic growth actually takes place.
Absolutely. Darren, we're moving towards the end of our time. Just one other thing I think is important, and I know you do look at this around the CMO, is people in the industry. How do we encourage people to continue the enthusiasm you talked about when you joined and it sort of had you bitten for life? Same for me. How do we encourage the younger people today to join and give them career opportunity in the decades ahead?
Well, I go back to the fact that over history, the resilience and growth of commercial aviation is unparalleled. I mean, no matter what, whether you're looking at near-term economic challenges, global shocks, or other impacts to demand for air travel, the industry has always bounced back, and it's always been a growth market. And it's because it's so inextricably linked to global economic activity, and so this is a growth market, which is a good thing when you're looking for a career. It's a growth industry. It's an industry that demands innovation in order to be successful, because as you and I both know, if you stand still, somebody's going to pass you, whether you're an airline, whether you're a manufacturer, or somewhere in between in that ecosystem. And so it's always engaging, it's always dynamic, so you'll never be bored. And I think also just a passion for the connection. You talk about the geopolitical challenges around the world. One thing I know from my own perspective that I've seen and found and continue to value is making connections globally actually helps with understanding and helps, minimize some of these global geopolitical, issues. And in aviation, connectivity and the growth of commercial air travel actually, I think, will help from a global perspective in terms of where we're headed in the next few years. And so it's a great industry to be a part of. It's rewarding for all the innovation and all the connectivity that we can help support. And it's a career that just keeps giving back, I think, in many ways. So I'm optimistic about the future, but I also think it's a great industry to be a part of because of the passion, right? It's just so fun and so exciting to be a part of an industry that connects the world.
Excellent. Well, Darren, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you today, looking at our future skies. And all I can say is if your CMO remains as accurate as it has been for the first 60 years, then the future skies should be pretty clear.
Absolutely.
So, Darren Holst, Vice President of Commercial Marketing at Boeing, many thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. That's it for now from our future skies. Our collection is complete. We've spoken with a diverse range of leaders across the series, embracing different geographies as well around the world, all of them giving us a clearer picture of the possible future of the airline industry. Don't forget, there are a range of insightful episodes in the collection to choose from, available on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for listening, and until the next time, goodbye from me, John Strickland.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.